Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a New York native and a creative writer. Plucked from obscurity at the age of 29, he rose up the political ranks before finally becoming a speechwriter and foreign policy advisor for President Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. He remained at the president's side for his entire tenure. His book, The World As It Is, Inside the Obama White House, gives us a unique insight into the everyday affairs of the Oval Office and his personal friendship with the US President. Ben Rhodes, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
Is it true to say, even as you guided the narrative of the United States foreign policy and President Obama's response to global events, you always have been and continue to be, first and foremost, a writer?
Yes, absolutely. That was my background. I wanted to tell stories. I thought I wanted to write fiction. That all changed for me on September 11th. I was a graduate student. I was working on a political campaign. And I saw the attacks unfold. I saw the second plane hit the World Trade Center, the first tower fall. And I knew that what I wanted to do next was going to be related to this event and the response to this event. But I thought I was going to be a writer. And I got into politics via speech writing. And I never lost that sense that, you know, what is most important in any job is your ability to communicate a story. Obama used to say our most important job, everything that we do here is about telling a story. And what he meant by that is not making things up. He meant that our words and our actions have to add up to something, because in politics, you're really expressing a story of who we are, in this case, as the United States of America.
Your first, I think, only published piece of fiction, The Goldfish Smiles, You Smile Back, yeah, is actually relevant to what you ended up doing.
You know, it's an eerie story to read for two reasons. One, it describes somebody who works for an amorphous corporation who rises through the ranks because they are able to capture what is actually being decided better than the people who are making the decisions, which is kind of one way of how people characterized me. It's not necessarily how I would. But the eerier thing to me was I wrote that story before the September 11th attacks. And the whole milieu of the story is that this guy is in a kind of anonymous American city. I actually had Houston in mind. And the world is a distant place. And it was kind of the pre-9/11 America. And what he becomes fixated on is the Taliban. And he watches the Taliban exploding those huge statues of the Buddhas, if you'll recall. And the last scene in the story is he's watching this television of them blowing up these statues, and he describes, this is someplace else far away. And in a really haunting way, this short story I wrote that was basically about the cocoon America was in and the distance to events like the Taliban in Afghanistan. Obviously, those attacks changed everything in America, and they changed everything for me. Suddenly, the world was not far away. It was very present in our lives, and everything that happened to me after those attacks had its point of origin in them.
Mm. Your route into politics very much centered around your involvement with Iraq. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I moved down to Washington. I tried to get a job for a magazine, and the editor of the magazine said, well, if you want to write and you want to learn about foreign policy, you should be a speechwriter. Nobody really thinks of becoming a speechwriter. So I got a job for a guy named Lee Hamilton, who ended up being the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission and then the co-chair of something called the Iraq Study Group, which was essentially a group of wise old hands who were meant to diagnose what had gone wrong in the Iraq War and recommend where the United States should go. And this is 2006. And, you know, it's kind of the height of the war gone wrong. And we interviewed all these people and got this picture of just decisions that had been made that were wrong, that were divorced from facts. We traveled to Iraq and spent a searing week there where every meeting confirmed kind of your worst sense of where things were going. You know, the Iraqi politics had devolved into sectarian militias. Different governments had different opinions about what was happening. And I remember just this sense that the people who were supposed to get this right after 9/11 had gotten it wrong. You know, this event that had propelled me into public life, the decision makers, George W. Bush, the people around him, had made these catastrophic series of decisions. And that's why I decided to get more actively involved in politics. I was like, if I actually want things to change, it's not enough to be in think tanks and to work on the Iraq Study Group. You know, I actually want to work in the presidential campaign.
And in fact, that's exactly what you ended up doing, not only as a speechwriter, but also in time as a foreign policy expert, largely because of that Iraq experience.
Yes.
Tell me your first impressions of Barack Obama.
I got in the door because, you know, even though I was so young, I was 29, and I think the book, part of the opportunity was to let people know what it's like to essentially enter an experience like that at that young an age, fairly anonymous, and how that transforms you. I had this experience with Iraq and 9/11 that made me somewhat a resource for a presidential campaign. And I was called into a debate preparatory session with Obama. So I walk into the room, the first time I ever met him, and he's sitting at the head of this table with all these advisors around him. And he had like his feet up on the desk, on the table, and he had this exuded this kind of calm and kind of cool in the room. It was kind of this magnetic, if some people have charisma because they jump up and grab you and take you by the arm, and he had kind of reverse charisma in that he just knew he was the most important guy in the room. And I was really nervous. I used to, which people don't believe now, have kind of a fear of public speaking, and I was nervous he was going to call me, and he did. And he was debating whether or not to vote for a piece of legislation that funded the Iraq War. And because I was nervous, I knew I couldn't speak in paragraphs. So I decided to ask him a series of questions. You know, don't you have an Iraq policy? Yes. Isn't this different from that policy? I mean, I'm shorthanding it. But basically, I led him through the logic train of, you have a policy, this isn't it, so why would you vote for it? And he liked that kind of common sense. The reason that clicked with him is that all the political considerations I didn't raise, like, will people call you weak if you vote against this? It was just the kind of common sense, pragmatic approach to a problem. I learned right away he liked that kind of brand of thinking. He didn't like to have his thinking polluted by what he thought were artificial political concerns.
And of course, eventually, you had to really get inside his head to produce his words. You had to achieve what some people call a mind meld.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
It's actually the job of a speechwriter. I mean, you have to occupy somebody else's worldview and use their words. Actually, it's a challenge to write this book because it's the first time in a decade that I was speaking for myself. What I did is, first of all, he's written a couple of pretty revelatory books, especially the first one, Dreams from My Father. It's a memoir he wrote before he knew he was going to be a politician. So it's very honest. And his whole worldview is there, his upbringing, how that informed how he thinks about the world. I read that over and over again. I also read the transcripts of his interviews. It didn't matter how obscure it was, some small radio station in rural America. I wanted to hear how he talked when the cameras weren't on, and how he liked to formulate sentences and how he liked to make arguments. Because, again, to be a speechwriter, you can write the best written document. If it's not in the voice of the person, particularly if it's someone who has a distinctive voice like Barack Obama, it's not going to work. And so I kind of worked my way into his head and his worldview and his manner of speaking. And because I felt an affinity for what he wanted to say, that was a lot easier. If I didn't agree with him, that would have been a pretty painful exercise.
You said a really interesting thing about writing for the first time in your own voice. And in the course of the book, you also say that in the 8 years of working with him, you sometimes felt that you might actually be losing who you were.
Yeah. Yeah, in a couple of ways. I wanted people to understand, first of all, on just a practical sense, the job is so all-consuming. Phone calls, from the phone calls that wake you up in the middle of the night to the last email you have to answer before you go to bed to the deluge you get when you wake up, your relationships change. I went from being engaged to married to having children. That was a difficult relationship to manage in the context of this job. You lose touch with other people in your life who are not working with you. But beyond that, when your entire identity is tied up in a political figure, for that long, 8 years, and it's rare for someone to stick around all 8 years in a White House, you become somewhat subsumed. Every time you speak publicly, you're speaking on their behalf. When every time you're writing in somebody else's voice. It is a peculiar experience, particularly when you're not an established public figure like I wasn't, to just have as that kind of single-minded focus, how can I help this guy say what he wants to say, defend what he's doing, help him accomplish what he wants to do, even the policies that I took on, like negotiating with Cuba, I did because I knew he wanted that to get done. And if I didn't do it, you know, it might not happen. You know, the book was in some ways reclaiming my own story after this experience.
And do you ever cross that boundary between staff member and friend?
It was interesting. After the first term, we were flying back on Air Force One from a trip to Asia. And he'd just been reelected. And he was talking to different people about what jobs they wanted to do in a second term. So like my friend Samantha Power, for instance, was going to be ambassador to the UN. So he calls me up to the front of the plane and he says, look, I'd really like you to stay at the White House, stay where you are. You should think about a project that you can do and take on that might make the job, you know, more interesting to you, that ultimately ended up being in Cuba. But then he said something interesting. He said, you're not just a staff member, you're a friend. And it's like he had to say that. And I remember I went back to my seat and I thought, well, that's interesting. And part of what he was saying was, I want you around because I need friends around. You know, like everybody's turning over and I'm comfortable with you. And we had a running conversation. And part of the style of the book is to let you in to how we talk in the car ride and in the hotel room and on the plane. And I realized how he didn't have those familiar faces around him. But the funny thing is, as I was musing on these questions of a friendship versus being a staff member, somebody came and said, okay, Obama just did this phone call. You have to go read out the press, you know. And I'm like, okay, I might be a friend, but I'm first and foremost a staffer.
But of course, like you, and indeed to a large degree like Samantha Power,
yeah,
he has the soul of a writer.
He really does. Again, I made the point about storytelling, but we had a fascinating conversation about it. I was in some tempest over the right wing used to love to say I was a fiction writer as if it was the worst thing you could call somebody. And my degree in creative writing, they said, it taught me to tell lies and all this stuff. And we had this interesting point where Obama said to me, you know, our whole job is about telling a story. And it's what I was saying before. But then he went further. He said, look, it's what makes us different from chimps. You know, every nation, every civilization, every community is basically rooted in a story. Like America's a story, like all men are created equal. They're endowed with their created by certain inalienable rights and everything flowed from that for good and bad. You know, we obviously didn't live up to that story at lots of points. So he's the soul of a writer in his belief that everything we're doing is adding up to a narrative that we're communicating about who we are as a country, about who he is as a person. He looked at issues with a writer's eye. You know, the foreign leader, he tried to understand kind of who they were, the type of background they came from. The foreign country, he tried to understand what's their story. You know, why are they in this place that they're in? What's the context for it? What's the history behind it? So that it informed his entire worldview.
Mm. And in terms of getting his words then out onto paper, I mean, you also talk about the fact that you actually had a lot of people lobbying you, trying to get their words into the speech. And I'm interested in the anatomy of one of his speeches, how it comes together, how much input you end up having, how much control you actually have, and how much he himself has to do with the words that come out of his mouth.
Yeah, so he, I mean, I described, for instance, one speech in the, a number in the book, but one is the speech he gave in Cairo to the Muslim world at the beginning of his presidency. And that was a good window into the process, because essentially, you know, he'd bring me in at the beginning of the process. For basically an hour, he would kind of narrate the outline of what he wanted to say. And he usually had, here's the story I want to tell. And the basic format of an Obama speech was usually, you know, how did we get to this moment? What is the history that led us here? What is the moment we're living in? Why is it important? What's at stake? And where do we want to go from here? And make several points. But he would narrate that outline. Then I'd have to write a speech. Then I would have to share that draft with a lot of people, political advisors, policy advisors, cabinet members. And then suddenly you go from being a writer to an editor, because everybody wants to turn the speech into their words. You know, they want to make this policy point, or they want to sand down this edgy point that Obama wants to make. And then it goes back to Obama, and he gets very engaged in the text. And on a speech like that, he'd edit, you know, 15, 20 times, writing in the margins, rewriting paragraphs. And what I learned over time is that if I took too many of the edits from the other people, he would get annoyed. He didn't like his voice. He understood if it was very critical that we had to change this phrase because we don't want to start a war or something. But I ended up having to say no to a lot of people. This is not what he wants to say. This is what he wants to say. I had influence, but I actually think some of those people thought I had more influence. I was doing what he wanted. I was preserving his voice and his ability to say things the way he wanted to say them. I wasn't kind of laundering my own views in. Mm. I was making sure he was expressing things as he wanted. And that was a complex process because you're balancing a lot of different equities, political, policy, and otherwise. But ultimately, if the statement wasn't authentically what he believed, he knew it wasn't gonna work.
You say that you diverged with him on policy opinion only twice. What was that?
There were two in particular. I think on Egypt, I had kind of been in the cohort of younger people who'd encouraged him to embrace the protests at the outset of the Arab Spring. And he had. And he had had this dramatic break with Mubarak, the president of Egypt. But then the kind of U.S. government reverted back to form of, like, we deal with the military, we're distrustful of democracy in Egypt. And Obama very much kind of wasn't willing to take that on. And it wasn't just Egypt. And as a general matter, on the Arab Spring in 2012, I was kind of out of step with him. He had basically taken the lay of the land from Egypt to Libya to Syria and determined, like, this is not going to turn out well. And we're going to have limited capacity to be able to change things on the ground. I think I was more hopeful and perhaps naive, perhaps idealistic, that more intervention from us could make a difference in those places. I described the process in the book of essentially kind of coming to his point of view through a mixture of inevitability, events, and just kind of facing hard reality. That was one. The other was around the Russian intervention in our election. I had seen Russia develop this essentially information warfare capability in Ukraine, where suddenly they were creating huge volumes of fake news using social media bots and other capabilities and flooding European news feeds with it. And they were now doing this in the U.S. election in 2016. The U.S. government's response was very much focused on the cybersecurity. You know, they hacked the Democratic Party. They released emails. And we weren't describing for people this volume of fake news that was being created. Obama felt like he wasn't going to be the right messenger to do that, that that would be an interference in the presidential election, but also that the people consuming that information, frankly, weren't inclined to listen to him anyway because they're consuming stories about Hillary Clinton being corrupt or unhealthy or what have you. Those are two areas where I was out of step with him, but I don't claim that I know that I was right. You know, it's not one of these books where it's like, if only they'd listened to me, everything would be fine.
Yeah.
It's just where I was at the time.
Now, there's so much in this book. It comes in at nearly 450 pages. It's a huge, huge work. And of course, you go into what you did in Cuba, the Iran nuclear deal, Syria, which is a big thing, and then the whole Benghazi investigation. People must read this book. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. Oh, and sadly, we don't have time to go into all of that. But just picking up on Russia, I know that you came to Britain, you went to Buckingham Palace, you met the Queen. There were some lighter moments.
Yeah.
Tell us about your involvement with Brexit, though, because Obama told you that Boris Johnson was Britain's Trump.
Yeah.
And he also said that some conservative circles in Washington have more in common with Putin than with him.
Yeah. So what happened is we were obviously anti-Brexit. We thought that was bad for Britain. We frankly thought it was bad for the United States. The Cameron people said they thought it'd be helpful if we came and made the case for the Remain campaign. And so we arrive here. Obama wrote an op-ed that I actually wrote for him, making the case against Brexit. That same day, Boris Johnson wrote a kind of hyperbolic response in which he suggested that Obama's hostility to Brexit was because he had a kind of Kenyan hatred for the British Empire. Or, you know, I forgot exactly how he phrased it. But it was, if not across the line, at a minimum, racially tinged. And Obama really was pissed, to use an artful word. And he said to me, look, the black eye doesn't like the Brits. That's really not a good look for Boris here, you know. I said, well, they're more subtle back home in terms of the dog whistles, the racial dog whistles. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, he's their Trump. And I said, well, better hair. But what he was really referring to is that Boris, you know, he's more articulate than Trump, obviously, more urbane, but he was expressing this kind of nationalist nostalgia, you know, make Britain great again. We can turn back the clock and keep the immigrants out and reverse globalization. And so his message was, you know, Obama thought quite similar to Trump's in that regard. Ultimately, in both of those campaigns, though, the emotion was with that brand of nostalgia. The rational case, you know, here's why Brexit would be bad that we made here and that Cameron and others were making, obviously wasn't enough to overcome the kind of emotional impulse that the Brexiteers were, I think, often untruthfully in their promises, stirring up in the public.
Well, if Boris is Britain's Trump, let's talk about America's Trump. You write about the last days of the presidency and Trump's inauguration platform being erected.
Yeah.
You describe it like a coffin for your own funeral.
Yes. I felt like the scene in As They Lie Dying, the Faulkner book, where they're building the mother's coffin outside her window. He did make this point, Obama, in the book, that Putin, and there was a common thread from Putin to Brexit to Trump. you know, it's obviously gradations of what I find to be more reprehensible, but all of it is expressing this kind of tribal backlash to a more integrated, inclusive world. And to see Trump get elected, it was worse than seeing just a Republican elected. It was kind of someone who stood for the opposite of everything Obama stood for.
I mean, but he talked about tribe, didn't he, President Obama? He said, what if we were wrong? Maybe we pushed too far. Maybe people just want to fall back into their tribe.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that was after the election, and he went through these various stages that I described in the book of trying to figure out what happened, like everybody else. But he's doing it from the perspective of having been the first African-American president. And I think what he was referring to there, we're riding the limousine in his last foreign trip, and he made this kind of jarring comment, what if we were wrong? I think what he was getting at is that progressives presume that things are going to move in the right direction. You know, there's an inevitability to society growing more inclusive and open and diverse, and that the backlash to that at home and around the world proved more potent than progressives had anticipated. And that's not a reason to compromise your beliefs. Frankly, I think in the American context and probably in the Remain campaign's context, that it was a failure to turn our people out. You know, I think he was suggesting that, you know, we can't take for granted progress, that frankly, going forward, we have to, the Obama legacy is not done. You know, people need to run for office. They have to get involved. We have to make sure that the country and the world looks more like the Obama brand of politics than the Trump brand of politics 10 or 20 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, in his final foreign speech as president, he said, the next American president and I could not be more different, but American democracy is bigger than any one person.
Yeah.
Do you think that still holds true, or is Trump basically screwing the world?
It doesn't look that way today. I take a pretty pessimistic view. I think he is diminishing the institution of the American presidency. But the pendulum swung dramatically from Obama to Trump. It can swing dramatically back. I still believe that the orientation of the United States, I don't think Trump represents the majority of the electorate, never mind the population of the United States. I still believe, even if you look at our elections now, there are more young people running, women running, people of color running. I do think that this is going to look better in 10 years. I just think Trump can do a lot of damage, and I think we shouldn't undersell the extent of the damage that he can do while he's there.
Now, obviously, Obama is no longer the president. It's not his job. But why is he silent? Is there anything that he could do or is doing that would reverse this appalling situation?
So the main reason, and I talked to him about this a lot still, he believes that if he was out there talking a lot, it's not just that he's trying to respect the norm of the past presidents not criticizing their successors. It has more to do also with the fact that if he was out there, that emerging voices couldn't step forward, that he would take up so much oxygen. If he played the role of kind of what the opposition leader does in the UK, for instance, you know, we need new national leaders in the Democratic Party. Like, part of the problem under the Obama presidency is he was such a big figure and the Clintons took up so much space. There was nobody else. We can't repeat that mistake. And so he's trying to provide that opening. He'll be out there campaigning in the next two elections. He's spending a lot of time behind the scenes trying to build up the infrastructure of the progressive movement in the United States and to help get young people involved in politics in the United States and around the world. But he can't be the front man anymore. He wants other people to step forward.
Why publish this book now?
You know, the most important thing to me was to tell this story. And when I left, I didn't know that I wanted to write a memoir. And frankly, I didn't like the genre. You know, political memoirs in the United States tend to be pretty depressing. It's like a mix of here's a list of meetings I was in and scores that I was settling in. But in conversations with people, I realized that the experience I had was essentially a coming-of-age story. I mean, to return to your kind of early questions about, you know, as a writer, I was 29 when I walked in the door and 39 when I walked out. My life was transformed. I wrote this book in part to figure out what happened to me, you know?
People describe you as a Holden Caulfield of politics, which I think is fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully a slightly more mature version. But, I mean, it was something to that of just like, I knew that if I did it reasonably well, that a reader could figure this world out better than through my eyes than they could through the eyes of a public figure like a Hillary Clinton or a John Kerry or, you know, who's distant. But that, you know, I might, if you could enter the experience through my own, you could both have this coming-of-age story And I could show you, here's what Obama's like as a three-dimensional character. Here's what it's like to actually work in the White House. Here's what it's like to travel around the world negotiating with Cubans and Iran. So to me, the opportunity was more the literary one than the political one, mm-hmm. of telling this story, having a kind of a traditional coming-of-age story, but through the context of politics. But honestly, the most important thing is that you write a book like this in part to figure out what happened.
Sure. Finally, Ben, President Obama asked you at the end, what makes history, individuals or movements? And then he answered his own question.
I don't know if it's a cop-out, but he said it was a team. It takes a team of people. It's somewhere in between, essentially. That it's not enough to have an amorphous social movement. It's not enough to have the charisma of one man. But if you put together the right people, that's where you actually connect the charisma and talents of an individual with a movement. You know, I think the point he was making is you have to connect the two.
And, of course, you were one of those people.
Well, I tried to be.
Ben Rhodes, thank you very much for talking to me. Ben is the author of The World As It Is, Inside the Obama White House. It's published by Bodley Head. It's available now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans and Lamichi Okamoto. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.